The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot-button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly. You're listening to the Cyber Law and Business Report, broadcast from Santa Monica, California, home of the Internet Law Center. And you may want to check out our blog. We have a ILC cyberreport.wordpress.com. We actually have background information on all the topics for today's show. Today we have a great show for you. We're featuring Josh Levy. He's with Free Press, and he's going to be talking about Stop Cyber Spying Week. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. But on the second half, we have Rebecca Wilkins, and she's with the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy, also the Citizens for Tax Justice, and she's going to talk to us about Dodgers, and not the team that Magic Johnson just bought, but Tax Dodgers. So we have a great show for you today. Today's a monumental day in history. It's the day when Paul Revere took his ride to warn the Patriots that Sarah Palin was coming. And but do we have Josh Levy with us?
Yes, hello.
Hi, Josh. Thank you for joining us. Actually, Josh, you're in Massachusetts, aren't you?
Yeah, we're in Western Massachusetts in Northampton. Beautiful.
That would be a long ride.
Yeah, it would. I think it would take a few days back in that time.
Yeah, the horse would get a little bit tired. But any event, thank you for joining us. Now, Josh, you're with Free Press, and you're their internet director. And Free Press is part of a broad group, a coalition of interest groups that have formed to launch Stop Cyber Spying Week. And can you tell us what that is?
Sure. We joined with a lot of our friends, including the folks at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the ACLU, VOZ, which is an international activism group, and others, to stop a bill that's called the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, which is known as CISPA. And this bill would grant sweeping powers to the National Security Agency and other government agencies to spy on what we're doing online and to capture all of that data and information and search through it as they wish without us being able to do anything about it. And the core of the law would actually make it easier for websites like Facebook, Google, and others to share the information that they have about us with the government without any blowback happening from either in a legal sense or from the public, because the public wouldn't necessarily know about it. In a sense, what this does is it codifies what the NSA has been doing for many years with its warrantless wiretapping scheme, collecting information on us and using it as it wishes for quote-unquote security purposes. What this would do is it would give Congress's blessing to that kind of behavior and make it officially legal.
And this goes back to the program, I think, that John Poindexter started in the early Bush years that got shut down in name only?
I can't actually speak to that. I think that there are a lot of security schemes and regimes that have taken root in the last many decades. And actually, this particular bill is just one of many that is floating out there right now. It's just the one that's has moved the furthest along in Washington. We're expecting to see a vote in the House next week. But there are others out there. I mentioned the warrantless wiretapping scheme from the NSA, but there are other schemes that have taken place in federal agencies for decades. So this is obviously something that the government does. It doesn't always do it transparently. In fact, it almost never does, and it doesn't do it in a way in which we have control over what kind of data can be seen by quote-unquote Big Brother. So this is really, for us, the first step in trying to protect Internet users from bills like this, and then going forward to give us more control over our data so that even if these schemes are taking place without our knowledge, we have some sort of way to protect ourselves.
And just so we're clear, we talked earlier on the show about some of the cybersecurity bills that have been pending, especially the battle in the Senate going on between McCain and Leahy. You know, that's a distinct subset. You know, that's dealing with the government vis-a-vis in businesses and how what to do in event of a cyber crisis or in a national crisis of any sort. Whereas this is really strictly about the intelligence community interacting with businesses on the cyber level.
That's right. This is specifically, again, about agencies like the NSA doing what they already do, but making it easier for them to get that information and making it easier for companies like Facebook, which supports the bill, to offer up our information without any fear of retribution.
Now, you make an interesting point about Facebook supporting the bill, and then I think right off the bat, you hear a lot of people saying this is the next SOPA, or this is SOPA on steroids, and it kind of reminds me of the early years after Watergate, where everything was the next Watergate. And with Facebook and several other businesses supporting it, it doesn't really seem to be similar to the experience where you saw the internet industry actually, being part of the opposition in SOPA.
Right. I think when people say this is the next SOPA, it's often that phrase is being used in two different ways. And some folks are particularly looking for attacks on people who are accused copyright infringers, but that doesn't really exist in this bill so much. There is some language about IP, but not a lot. And then others, I think, are seeing more generally that this is the next attack on the open internet. And sure, you could say that this is an attack in the way that SOPA was an attack that had external effects by trying to deal with copyright infringement. But the actual substance of these two bills is pretty different. And you could broadly say that this is like SOPA in that its intended effect is one thing, and the actual effect that it would have on how we use the internet is quite another. It would have both bills would have had a chilling effect on our ability to share information online, and as a result, would have had a chilling effect on our ability to maintain free speech online. So in that way, they're similar, but one is dealing with security, specifically cybersecurity. The other was supposed to be a bill that was dealing with copyright infringement. Another way in which you could say that they are sort of similar is that they have raised the ire of internet users across the country and around the world. And the fact that, as you said, big businesses are actually supporting CISPA when they opposed SOPA shows that the business community can sometimes be fair-weather friends when it comes to bills that are attacking the open internet. And if something is supporting their business interests, then they may stay quiet or they may actually support the bill. And if it's attacking their business interests, you may have them on your side.
And why do you suppose Facebook is supporting the bill?
It makes it easier for Facebook to share the information it's being asked to share anyway. So rather than it dealing with some legal grayness, when it's being asked to give up, for example, my Facebook profile and my entire history on the site, this makes it very clear what its legal obligations are and indemnifies them from any kind of blowback so that they can give up that information without any fear that the legal system is going to catch up with them or that users are going to say, hey, you're not supposed to do this. This is illegal.
And then the NSA gets to have the information Facebook has since they probably have more than the NSA. Now, you said that this would have a chilling effect or an inhibiting effect on speech on the internet. And how would that be? What part of the bill do you see that causing that?
Well, it's kind of the broad effect of the bill. If right now, more or less, on a wireline connection, meaning not on your mobile phone, because the mobile internet is not protected in the same way that your wireline connected internet is protected.
Right.
You have more or less assurance that the things that you say online you can say without any fear of censorship, without any fear that a corporation is going to block it, and without any fear that if you say the wrong thing, you will somehow suffer the consequences of not being able to connect to a site or having the information that you're giving up come back to haunt you. But we're going down a road in which those things are not going to be the case anymore. And a bill like this, when you know that everything that you do, every email that you send, even on your cell phone, every text message, even though that's not the internet, that's covered under this bill as well. Every video that you watch, every text, every internet, instant message that you send, all that stuff is being crawled by the NSA. It will have an effect where you won't feel free to say things on the internet anymore. If you're having a private conversation with somebody that you realize isn't so private anymore, you won't have that conversation on the internet. And given that the internet has become the primary way in which we communicate with each other, and is increasingly so for most people, that chilling effect is a chilling effect on free speech at large. And so what we're doing here, just in order to stop this bill, is actually protecting our ability to speak online without fear that at any moment an agency could say, hey, we just saw what you said, and we're not so happy about it.
But is the effect really just be the awareness that you're being watched, not necessarily any difference in the actuality that you are being watched?
I think that we've seen, if you look at a parallel example of innocent people being caught up in no-fly lists, for example.
Yes.
And they're trying to get on an airplane and say, oh, no, your name's on this list, even though you haven't done anything wrong. That if that were to go to an extreme, would have a real effect on people's sense that they can go where they want to. And in fact, a lot of people have been restricted in movement because of no-fly lists, even though they haven't done nothing wrong. If you take that to every internet user and you see innocent people getting caught up in this net and realizing that, hey, wait a minute, the NSA is watching me and may make some mistakes, may see that my name looks like somebody else's name, or may think that I'm saying something that I'm not, that is, in a lot of people's opinion, going too far. And it's an infringement on our privacy. It's an infringement on our ability to speak freely online. So that's one of the big reasons why we're all uniting against this bill.
And it seems you've had somewhat of an immediate effect. Already the sponsors have been backtracking and have come up with, I've seen, I guess, two subsequent drafts. But just for listeners, the status of the bill is it has been approved by the House Intelligence Committee, which then is the final step before it goes to the floor for a vote on the House. And subsequent to that, and with your group's opposition, they've now released two amendments to the bill in response. And now the White House is putting heat on as well. What has your reaction been to the amendments?
Our reaction has been that they don't solve the problem at all, and several in the privacy community have actually suggested that these amendments or working drafts served to make the bill even worse than it was to begin with. So until our issues are addressed and our concerns are met, we're not going to lay off opposing this bill, because the fundamental problem that we're facing here is, again, this transfer of information between private companies and national agencies like the NSA. So until there are some restrictions placed on how that information is transferred, and our ability to control our information online, I don't think that we're going to lay off this bill.
And I guess that really does beg the question, is can you foresee a circumstance when you would support the bill, given the direction it's going?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that any of the groups involved are thinking about whether or not we can support this bill. The bill is what it is today, and in that form, we oppose it. It's speculation to think about what the bill could become, and if it changes sufficiently, then we will have a conversation about that. But today, we continue to oppose it.
What is driving the bill now? Why now?
The argument being laid out by the members of Congress who are introduced this bill and who are supporting it, and then those in Washington who are supporting other similar bills, is that there are security threats online that need to be dealt with immediately. And I have no doubt that that's true. And I think everyone in the coalition of groups that's pushing against CISPA respects that. And I think they rather than thinking that it's one or the other, that and beyond the fact that we can protect security without infringing on people's privacy. In fact, when you do create these privacy risks for individual citizens, you decrease security at large, and I think that there's a way that you can make a bill that makes us more secure and protects our privacy. So we're waiting for something like that to come along, and we're definitely communicating to people in Washington that that is the way to go about protecting our security and making us safer, is to also protect our privacy.
Now, granted, this is a relatively new field, and you know, we're all starting to get our arms around the issue of cybersecurity. But are there any other countries that have tried to address that in a manner that's more protective of privacy?
You know, I can't really address that because I'm not an expert on what other countries outside of the U.S. are doing. I do know that this is a struggle for every country. And we've seen particularly repressive regimes like China and others take really extreme measures in blocking people's internet access for quote-unquote security reasons. And we know from experience that ends up sweeping up very real activists and it silences political speech. And that's the worry that we have here, is that one person's security is another person's political speech, and we need to come up with a much fairer way of dealing with security than this bill proposes.
And also we have the problem that our history is such that when we've dealt with this and other technologies in the past, we haven't had a great record entirely. You know, and if you look back to the 50s, and you know, we haven't always been, we've gone overboard sometimes.
Absolutely. You know, the 50s is especially a terrible moment when it comes to our privacy. But you can even look back to 10 years ago in the last decade and the warrantless wiretapping scheme that I referred to earlier, for which AT&T was given retroactive immunity, you know, because it was voluntarily giving up information to the government without telling its users. This stuff is probably happening now with Google and Facebook and possibly other companies. And what this is doing, again, is just codifying that behavior. So we've already seen overreach here, and we don't see a need to make that overreach an actual law so that it's that much harder to stop.
Has anyone put Google or any of the other ones on the spot as to whether or not they are doing this?
Yes, they have, and some companies are more transparent than others about what information they give up. I know that Google produces a report every year that shows exactly what information is being asked to give up. Twitter has a better record and actually will alert its users when those users' information is being subpoenaed, and other companies have their own policies. I think Facebook has taken some heat in this for two reasons, because it has openly supported this bill, and also because it is a huge kind of elephant in the room when it comes to privacy and information that's online. You know, it has it's closing in on 1 billion users around the world. It has many tens of millions of users here in the U.S., and we recognize the fragility of our privacy when it comes to Facebook in a law like this, and our awareness, the NSA has probably already been crawling Facebook for information. So in addition to stopping this particular bill and other bills like it, I think it's time for us to be more proactive to help protect users going forward so that we don't have to constantly fend off threats like this.
Well, Josh, we're going to crawl to a break in just now. And when we come back, we'll have Josh Levy. We'll be talking more about the battle against CISPA and the Stop Cyber Snooping Week after this.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Do you look at the task of ranking your site at the top of the search engines like you would climbing the top of Mount Everest? It doesn't have to be. TopSEOs.com knows how hard that climb can be, and they can make top ranking a reality. Top SEOs send you to only the right search vendors and agencies that they know will work for you. Since 2002, TopSEOs.com has reviewed and researched the best search engine marketing agencies and solutions providers. Don't risk the cost of falling off the proverbial peak of search rankings. Let Top SEOs give you peace of mind. TopSEOs.com, the independent authority on search vendors.
Johnson, what's this mantis I keep hearing about? Do we need to call an exterminator?
No, sir. Moby Mantis is our new SMS marketing tool.
SM what?
SMS. Text messaging. Moby Mantis lets us communicate directly with our customers in real time. We can send promos, coupons. It even lets our customers market for us by sharing offers with their friends online. It's been great for business.
Sounds expensive.
Actually, I sign us up for an extended free trial. It hasn't cost us a dime.
Good work, Johnson. I guess the only thing we'll be exterminating is the competition.
To get your free extended trial of Moby Mantis, text RADIO to 21691. That's RADIO to 21691 for Moby Mantis.
As you know, being an expert at f***.
What did she say?
Requires lots of practice and a great tool. Think you could use some help with f***?
Whoa!
You're not alone. Hundreds have used our tool to take their f*** performance to the next level.
The language!
Of course, we're talking about managing Facebook ads on Acquisio.
Oh.
Buy, track, manage, optimize, and report on media across all major ad networks. Visit Acquisio.com to get a demo today. Acquisio. Search, social, display, one platform.
Cyberspace, the final frontier. These are the voyages of your new business enterprise. Its ongoing mission to explore strange new domains, to seek out new sites and new monetizations, to boldly go where no one has gone before. Webmasterradio.fm. So logical. You'll go out of your Vulcan mind.
Webmasterradio.fm. We're everywhere.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back. This is Bennett Kelly. I have Josh Levy from Free Press. Free Press has been on our show before talking about the battle over net neutrality, and they're in front and center in this battle as well. Josh, I had a question. I went to your website, and you have the sign the petition to stop the online spying bill. And actually, I do kind of like the graphic, the please wait, we're reading your email. But since you guys have launched this, do you have any metrics for what the results have been?
We have metrics for Free Press, and we also have, I think, a lot of activity that we can talk about across this coalition of groups that we talked about before. For us, we're nearing about 50,000 people taking action on this.
Wow.
Many thousands of people have used Twitter to tell their member of Congress to oppose this bill. There's been a coordinated Twitter campaign across all these groups. And then across this coalition, again, of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, ACLU, and others, I would say that at the very least we're approaching 500,000 people taking action.
Wow. Now, if I recall, one of the suggestions was to Twitter your member of Congress with everything you do today. So they get the sense of the amount of data that's going to be collected.
Well, you know, it's like use data to save data. there's a cool tool created by the EFF and also by our friends at Fight for the Future that allows people to put in a simple phrase of what you're doing. For example, watching, I don't know, reruns of The Muppets on Netflix, and then it will send a tweet to your member of Congress saying, "Dear member of Congress, does the NSA really need to know that I'm watching reruns of The Muppets on Netflix?" And then with a link to take action. So Twitter is actually a very effective way of communicating opposition to a bill or support for a bill to Congress. And so it's one prong of this multi-pronged attack that we launched earlier this week.
And if people want to get more information, they should go to your website, EFF. Excuse me, not EFF. I'm sorry. At freepress.org.
I would go to freepress.net or to savetheinternet.com, okay, which is the site that focuses on all of these internet issues.
Now, while I have you, where do we stand on the battle over net neutrality? Is there hearing dates yet?
Not quite yet, but we expect to hear some soon. There, as people probably know, the FCC passed open internet rules in December 2010, and there were several lawsuits launched in reaction to that, including one from us, which is pushing the FCC to make those rules stronger and to include the wireless internet alongside wireline internet. So we're still waiting to hear what the actual timeline is going to be on those.
Yeah, it's been some time since the petition was filed. I was wondering when that might happen. That is expected to be at some point this year, the arguments.
It is.
And now, if with the few minutes we have left, if there are people who want to learn more and get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
The best way, I guess, would be to seek me out on Twitter. I'm at levjoy. And also, just to go again to freepress.net and savetheinternet.com, you can find me there. You can find many of my colleagues there, and you can learn a lot more about these issues that we were discussing.
And, well, I want to thank you for joining us, and we're going to transition to our next guest in a few minutes, but please keep us posted and let us know how this progresses. It's you know, after seeing the response to SOPA, you know, we actually had some people involved in the social media aspect of the campaign, that it's interesting to see the internet activism and it finally having an effect on Capitol Hill. So definitely keep us posted, and I hope you consider joining us again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Well, as I mentioned, today is a monumental day in history. Not only did it begin with Paul Revere's ride, and no, he did not warn the Patriots about Sarah Palin, but it is also a number of significant things have happened over time. Today is the anniversary of the great San Francisco earthquake of 1906, and in looking at it, there's actually video footage from that era, and it's just remarkable. If any of you have ever been to Germany, and particularly the town of Cologne, which was just devastated by the bombings in the war, but miraculously there was this cathedral that was unscathed. There were parts of San Francisco that actually looked that way, and so that's one significant anniversary. It's also the anniversary of Albert Einstein dying, unfortunately, but more importantly, it is the anniversary of the longest baseball game in history. People showed up, several thousand people showed up at 8 o'clock in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, to see the Pawtucket Red Sox play the Rochester Red Wings, which featured Hall of Famers on both sides, Wade Boggs for Pawtucket and Cal Ripken for Rochester. And at 4 a.m., after 32 innings, it was still tied. And they looked up the curfew rules, and they decided to continue it to another day. And the game was finished 2 months later or a month later, and Pawtucket won, and it was still the longest game in history. So that all started this day in 1981. So by understanding, we have our next guest, Rebecca. Are you with us?
I am.
Thank you for joining us. Rebecca Wilkins is the Senior Tax Counsel for the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy and the Citizens for Tax Justice. What's the relationship between the two organizations?
The Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy is primarily our number crunchers. They're the folks who do the analysis and data stuff, and Citizens for Tax Justice is an advocacy organization.
Okay. And you know, in terms of the number crunching and stuff, you guys put out quite a few reports on you know, tax sheltering and tax abuse, and you just recently released another one, how the big no tax corporations. You just released a couple about 2 weeks ago, I believe. And why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that report was an update of a major study that we released in November. The November report looked at the Fortune 500, and it took us over a year to complete that study. And what we found, 280 of those Fortune 500 companies were consistently profitable over all 3 years that the study covered, which was 2008 to 2010. But on average, they only paid a federal income tax rate of 18.5%, which is about half of the 35% rate that is provided in the law. And of those 280 companies, 30 of them paid a negative tax rate over that three-year period, so they didn't pay any federal income taxes at all, even though collectively those 30 companies earned $160 billion in profits.
Wow.
And the study that we just released updated the November study. Now the 2011 financial statements have been filed with the SEC, and so we looked at whether or not they paid tax in 2011, and again, most of them didn't. Over the four-year period, 26 of those 30 companies still have negative tax rates.
And some of them are very well-known names to our listeners, ranging from General Electric, who I guess their tax rate was negative 45% in 2010 and then negative 18.9% in 2011.
Yes, and GE's been, of course, in the news a lot. There have been some articles written about their amazing ability to avoid paying U.S. income taxes. And so we've been following GE for a long time. And over the last 10 years, they've averaged only 2.3% in U.S. income taxes.
That's incredible. And it seems that there's a high concentration of energy industry players in this, in terms of your list of the no tax people, but it's not exclusively that. I mean, for example, Interpublic is in there, Verizon. There are technology companies there as well. What is there any common thread in what companies tend to fall in this category?
Well, the report that we did in November classified companies by industry, and there are some industries that pay a lot lower tax rate than other industries. For example, financial institutions, big pharma, pharmaceuticals, and high tech tend to pay lower rates. The defense contractors pay a very low rate. On the high end, retail companies tend to pay a much higher rate. And I think part of that is because it's much harder to disguise where your sales are when you're a retail company.
True. And kind of working backwards, before your current report, you did a report December on corporate tax dodging in the 50 states.
Yes, our November report was on federal income taxes. And then in December, we followed that up with a report on what corporations are actually paying in the states. The average income tax rate for corporations in the states is 6.8%, but we found again that they're only paying about half that.
And it's an interesting point to raise, because we've had a number of shows where we've talked about what is known as the Amazon tax, extending the quill nexus, so to speak, to include companies that you sell in state through affiliate marketers. And a lot of what's driving that is kind of states are cash starved, and
sure. And
here's part of the reason why they're cash starved.
Yeah, Amazon's a famous tax dodger. They pay a really low income tax rate, and then they do everything they can to avoid collecting sales tax for states. They don't pay the sales tax. All they do is collect it and then pass it on to the state revenue departments, but they've really been fighting even doing that.
Yeah, it's an interesting study, because on one hand they say, oh my God, you can't make us do it. That is just oh so hard. And then they do it every day, and that's the back end for a number of companies like, for example, Target.
Right, absolutely, yeah.
And so I guess consistency or disingenuousness is not necessarily disqualify you in this arena.
No,
but,
it's really unfortunate to have such an anti-tax bias, because, I buy things on Amazon occasionally, and it has nothing to do with the fact that they don't collect sales tax from me. It's all about the enormous number of products that are available and how it's so much easier to find it than trying to, schlep around to all the retail stores here where I live. And I'd gladly pay the sales tax.
I mean, Amazon has distinguished themselves as an online community. And, going back to just, for example, suggesting products, they were one of the early innovators in that. You're right. I mean, people go to Amazon for a number of reasons unrelated to the tax differential.
Right. And it's now, all of these big corporations benefit from all the things that we do collectively by paying taxes and having government, just like all of us do as individuals. They use our roads. They use the court system to enforce their contracts. They use police and fire protection. They use up services that government provides, sometimes at a much higher rate than other taxpayers do. They also benefit enormously from the research and development that the U.S. government subsidizes. I mean, the government basically paid for the development of the Internet.
Right.
And so it's really, I think, galling to a lot of people that they don't seem to think they ought to help pay for those services.
Which I guess would then be a good point to talk maybe a little bit about Apple. There's been a lot of focus on them lately because, one, there was a report that they had more cash on hand than the U.S. government, and two, that part of the reason why what they're doing is they're sheltering their income offshore by more or less allocating transactions to foreign IP in what probably is somewhat of an artificial way. Could you speak to that?
Yes, definitely. So just a little bit of background on how the U.S. system works. If you're a U.S. company and you have operations overseas, you're taxed on your worldwide income, but you don't have to pay tax on your foreign income until you bring that back to the U.S. or until you repatriate it. And then when you do, you get a credit for any foreign taxes that you paid. So if you've already paid tax on it somewhere else at a rate close to what the U.S. rate is, then you won't pay any more tax on it when you bring it back. And Apple, a few weeks ago, announced dividends and a share buyback program, and they specifically said they were going to use the cash that they have here in the U.S., that they were not going to repatriate dollars from their foreign subsidiaries because they didn't want to pay the tax. And what's really amazing about the Apple case is that we can see in their financial statements that their effective foreign rate is only about 4%, which means that they're not booking those profits in France or Germany or the UK or places that have a pretty healthy corporate tax rate. They're booking those profits primarily in tax haven countries where there is no corporate income tax.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to continue this discussion about the iTax cheat known as Apple after these messages.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
MySEOTool.com is your all-in-one SEO management resource. MySEOTool.com makes it easy to optimize and oversee all of your SEO efforts. Line-by-line detailed reports help you identify any problems and show you how to fix them. MySEOTool.com is completely automated. Once you use it, you will see a rise in your search rankings and traffic. Try MySEOTool risk-free today. Go to MySEOTool.com. MySEOTool.com.
The Web Marketing Association is now accepting entries into the 16th Annual International Web Award Competition. Independent judges from around the world recognize the best websites from nearly 100 industries. Web Awards winners receive an image plaque, certificate of achievement, higher visibility for your company, valuable feedback from our expert judges, and links to your site from the highly ranked Web Awards site. You can't win if you don't enter. Sign up now at www.webaward.org.
Oh yeah, my day is done. Time for happy hour.
You're already done for the day?
Yeah, because I use CertifiedKnowledge.org. Their PPC tools literally save me hours every day.
How do you keep on top of all of Google's new features?
Easy. With Certified Knowledge, their interactive learning modules keep me up to date. And if there's something I don't know, I can watch their video lessons without having to hunt around the Google help files.
Great. I'm ready to expand my knowledge.
Hi, I'm Brett Geddes. I'm the only leader officially supported by Google to teach the advanced track of the AdWords Seminars for Success. I personally recommend CertifiedKnowledge.org as your one-stop shop for all your PPC needs.
Learn, optimize, connect. Be smart. Go to CertifiedKnowledge.org now.
The Web Marketing Association is now accepting entries into the 16th Annual International Web Award Competition. Independent judges from around the world recognize the best websites from nearly 100 industries. Web Awards winners receive an image plaque, certificate of achievement, higher visibility for your company, valuable feedback from our expert judges, and links to your site from the highly ranked Web Awards site. You can't win if you don't enter. Sign up now at www.webaward.org.
Webmasterradio.fm, keeping you out of rush hour traffic.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
And we're back. This is Bennett Kelly. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report, and I have Rebecca Wilkins, and we are talking about tax dodgers, and not the Los Angeles Dodgers, but tax dodgers, and we're talking about Apple. And Rebecca, I remember right after 9/11, Stanley Tools in Connecticut sought to do what is known as the Bermuda inversion, as to reincorporate in Bermuda to avoid, you know, millions in state and federal taxes. And there was such a backlash about how unpatriotic this company that had been in Connecticut since the 19th century would just do that. And, you know, this doesn't seem to be much backlash today for a lot of companies. And we were talking about Apple. I know there's some movement to try to single out Apple for being a major tax cheat.
Well, unfortunately, all of the U.S. multinationals are pretty aggressive, we think, in offshoring profits to foreign subsidiaries. You know, some are probably more aggressive at it than others. But it just seems to be the norm among those companies that they try to play games and accounting tricks and move profits around the world just on paper, so that they can pay very little or no corporate income tax here in the U.S. You know, they play the same game among the states, too.
Right.
They move their U.S. income to states that don't have an income tax or have a much lower rate.
And you may have seen some of the videos out there with trying to draw attention to Apple in particular. Because do you get a sense of it having any traction?
I do think that just the whole debate is getting a lot of traction. There's been some press. You know, there's been some articles looking at Apple's financial statements. And, for example, there was an article just kind of pointing out the stuff in the financial statements that sort of indicate that Apple is being pretty aggressive in offshoring their profits. It pointed out that, you know, 54% of its assets of its plant, property, and equipment are in the U.S. 69% of its retail stores are in the U.S., and yet they only report 30% of their profits as U.S.-sourced profits. Most of their research and development is here in the U.S., so the value that they're creating is being done here in the U.S., and yet when they file their tax return, they say only 30% of their profits are in the U.S., and it just kind of doesn't pass the smell test.
No, it doesn't. And I don't know if you saw, Eric Altman did a really good piece on Apple and Steve Jobs, too, and how, you know, basically he's been sainted, beatified by the business community, when in reality he didn't even meet up to, you know, Andrew Carnegie's rule that the man who dies rich dies disgraced. And one of the question I had on this is as we start talking about offshore shelters. I noticed that I saw an interview you gave where you talked about the presumptive nominee Mitt Romney's use of foreign tax havens. Do you think that's going to be a major issue in the campaign? And
well, we certainly hope it is. We are actually pretty happy to see Romney as the nominee because it puts the issues that Citizens for Tax Justice has been working on for over 30 years in the limelight, and people are talking about them. You know, you used to think that using offshore investment vehicles was something only the super, super wealthy did, and you had to sneak money out in a suitcase to Switzerland or something. And with the advent of the Internet and the explosion in the offshore tax haven world, a lot of folks are doing it now, not just the super, super wealthy. Again, for a U.S. citizen, you're taxed on your worldwide income. So moving something offshore shouldn't keep you from paying tax on it. But if you have it offshore, it's really easy to cheat. You know, it's really easy to not report that income. Because unlike here in the U.S., where our employer sends a W-2 to the IRS and our bank sends a 1099 telling the IRS how much we earned on our deposit account, the foreign banks and the foreign mutual fund companies and the private equity firms and hedge funds that are located offshore don't have to send that information to the IRS. So if you wanted to cheat on your tax return, that makes it really easy. And, you know, I've looked at Romney's tax returns in detail, and he has disclosed all of his foreign holdings, or at least it looks like he has. And, I mean, 55 of the pages in his tax return were just disclosures of transactions with offshore corporations and partnerships and trusts. So it doesn't look like he's trying to use those offshore entities to cheat on his personal taxes. But I find it really troubling that Bain Capital has recently been putting all of its private equity funds in the Cayman Islands. Because even if Romney and the other Bain partners aren't using that Cayman Islands jurisdiction to cheat on their own taxes, they're really making it easy for their investors to cheat.
They're facilitating it.
Absolutely. And it just really bothers me to think that they think that that's okay.
You know, I'm here in California, where we're home to, you know, the Los Angeles Dodgers, but also the tech community. And, you know, here in California, we're going through budget crisis. We're seeing major strains in our once, you know, very strong educational system. And then you're hearing the tech community say, well, you guys aren't graduating enough talented people. We need more visas from overseas so we can bring in the people with PhDs, or we need to offshore it. But then at the same time, they're offshoring the income and not paying taxes so that we can have the educational system that would give them the people they need.
That's right. Yeah, if they would contribute to the state and federal governments, we could work on things like making sure we have a better education system and that we're helping people earn the degrees that they need and get the training that they need.
It's unfortunate. But, yeah, I was, you know, I still think back to the Stanley Tube backlash, but I think that was just such a peculiar period where it was such an old-line company and it was so close to 9/11 that I don't know if you could have that backlash again.
I think a lot of it is just bringing the issue to the attention of folks. I mean, just what we've seen in the last couple of weeks with the ALEC,
yes,
the Legislative Exchange Council, having a lot of its big corporate sponsors pull out, and they've announced that they're going to change their behavior. I mean, I think the same kind of public pressure needs to be brought to bear on these corporations that are doing everything they can to avoid paying any income taxes.
But it is hard to formulate this at a mass level. I mean, because generally discussions of taxes tend to generate into yes or no, too much or too little. But then when you get into certain nuances, well, they're sheltering offshore. I mean, it's hard to capture people on that.
Right.
You would know better than anyone.
It's kind of technical, geeky stuff that, you know, those of us in the wonk world like. But it is, I think, difficult for the average person on the street to wrap their head around.
But at the same time, what you guys, I think, do a good job of is when you see that GE has a negative tax rate and, you know, I'm paying whatever, then that resonates, I think, with people.
I think that is where people at least get it. You know, if you know that you paid more taxes in 2010 than GE did to the federal government, I think people get that. I think people, when you tell them that GE has, for example, 975 people in their tax department, and they're charged with not only complying with the tax laws in all the places where they file tax returns, but looking for tax opportunities to save taxes everywhere. They're supposed to spend half their time looking for those opportunities. And then you look at how much they spend on lobbying and how much they give in campaign contributions to the members of Congress that sit on the tax writing committees. I think you can draw some lines that people understand.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know there have been efforts in the past to limit government contracts to companies that use abusive shelters. Has that ever gotten traction?
No. Unfortunately, that hasn't passed. The Government Accountability Office in 2008 issued a report showing that 83 of the 100 largest companies in the U.S. had subsidiaries in offshore tax havens, as did most of the top contractors with the federal government.
So cutting off our nose instead of our face. We only have 2 minutes left, Rebecca. So if people want to learn more about this issue or contact you, what's the best way they should do that?
The best way is to go to our website, which is ctj.org. You can find our November report and the update that we just did on the no tax paying corporations and all of the issues that we work on, and get more information about the issues and see what we're up to.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure, and I hope you consider coming back again, maybe next April. Keep up the good work. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for having me.
And in the short time we have left, today is also in history, there's another anniversary. It's the anniversary of the Beirut bombing, and it was the largest explosion, a non-nuclear explosion since World War II, on that day in 1983. And which we lost some 200 Marines. And so our thoughts go out to the families of those who were lost. And this has been a fun show today. I'm glad you were able to join us. This is Bennett Kelly with the Internet Law Center here in Santa Monica. Check out our blog, WordPress.com. We always have updates on internet law, but also we have details on the various issues we cover during the show. So it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Court is adjourned, and I look forward to talking to you next week here from Santa Monica, the Internet Law Center. Good week.